For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits.
Don Mazzella here again for Small Business Digest. We have a really interesting guest with us, Stefan Figley. Did I pronounce it correctly, Figley?
Yes, sir.
Okay. He's with us. We're going to talk about what I consider an interesting subject, but we'll let him tell us about that after. First, we ask our usual questions. His personal background, what's he doing now? And I love it when you guys come on with your company's logo on there. It makes life so much simpler. And then finally, a website. So, Stefan, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Don. I really appreciate it. Give you a quick on my background. I've been in franchising for a little over 20 years, a certified franchise executive. I've worked on multiple brands from B2C to B2B. I've worked 100% in the service industry. So it's all been around home services or commercial services. So I've had a lot of experience in that. Prior to that, I came out of the marketing side of business. And so I actually worked for one of the largest marketing agencies in the world, Leo Burnett, out of Chicago. Worked all over the world. I did not do the creative. I'm not the guy that drew all the stuff or comes up with all that. I was the guy that did all the analytics. I proved the ROI of the marketing proposals that were put into large brands. Brands that you guys have all heard of, McDonald's, Philip Morris, Diageo. I worked on Chevrolet, a lot of brands all over the world. Got some great experience doing that. Corporate-wise, I worked with ServiceMaster Corporate, multiple brands within them, and that's where I got into my franchising world. So prior to that, I was a tennis pro. So
okay. Let me ask you a question, Stefan, which I always wanted to ask. The franchising industry is kind of a unique industry, okay? Every industry is unique. But what attracted you to franchising?
Yeah, so franchising is unique because you have a support mechanism in place. You have a process that you can follow. If you start a business on your own, you're coming up with everything that you're trying to identify, what you need, what you design, what's required to run the business and make you grow is all coming from you. So you're doing all that research or spending all that time. With a franchise system, there's usually a brand in place, there's national marketing, there's a brand presence in place, processes, etc. So you have something to grip on to start your business. Then it becomes, as a business owner, it becomes what you can drive from that. So that's what I like about it, is supporting folks.
Well, people argue that what you're doing is in effect buying a salary.
No, I will argue that one, and I can probably give you some proof of why that's not true.
Well, I've been to the show for years. I know the good and the bad of franchising. The bad about it is some people simply won't follow the franchising rules. They're the ones that usually go by the wayside.
Yep, that's correct. If you look at even just from what we do at 1-800-PACKOUTS, the folks that think they have a better way to do it or a shortcut have a slower growth process in their first 12 to 18 months to hit certain revenue numbers, versus the folks that are just following the process and then working on their business. And I've got the numbers to back that up for sure. But it is not buying a salary by any means, because it is still your business. You are the owner. The franchise system is, and they all vary, but in the service world, it's a process. You're entering an industry. They've got a process to follow. It's been proven. They have several other owners, depending on how big they are. If they're emerging, they still have them that prove that revenues can generate to these certain numbers. That's the benefit that you're getting. if you want to follow that, you've got a roadmap that can help you. You still have to show up every day and put that in. And until you make the revenue, you don't have a salary. That is being your own business owner. That's the case. There is no guaranteed you make this every month. It's not there. You still are your own business owner. And so that's the difference for sure.
Well, let's back up, if I may, and ask you a couple of questions, which always come up in our focus groups, etc. Well, the first one is, well, what if you have one or two store franchise, that's one thing. But if you have five or six, which really is a point at which you really make money, how do you find the people to run your business when you're not there?
Yeah, so it takes knowing your business and then doing the right recruiting, and that's how you're going to find them. It's just like any other way, but you're going to find that. So, being in a franchise system, we try to help that. We give some guidance around personas, concepts, mentalities, etc. We have some research that's been done off of the existing people that have GMs, so that they're not working in the business every single day. So they have a general manager that's running their operation. But as you get started, most of those folks were in the business for at least 12 months. They worked it themselves. They did the operations. They know what's going on in the bookkeeping elements. And then they say, I want to be a little more absentee. That's an investment that they make. So if you were making certain money and you now want to make it absentee, you still have to put the right people in it to continue that growth. Sometimes you see it, and I think you kind of mentioned it. Folks try to step out and it plateaus. It only stays at the same thing. They got to keep finding the right people. So we help them from for example, on a franchising side, we have some job descriptions, then we have some personality traits that they should look at to hire and types of questions that they could consider as they look for these individuals. We also have some partners that work within our industry to find talent that meet that criteria for them so that they're not starting from scratch. And that's the benefit of that franchise system as well. So that's how they can find out to step out of the business.
Well, prior to this, finding people who didn't want to be entrepreneurs but rather have a salary was relatively easy. But as you notice, a lot of people are becoming entrepreneurs in this world today. And they're the people that I always think were the GMs of the future. Is that, you've seen that it's harder to find the general managers of your businesses?
Yes, it's getting a little more difficult. I think more people are becoming entrepreneurs, so there's less of the trained individuals to run a business. Many of those folks are finding their opportunities, whether it's their own, they're starting their own, or they're moved into a franchise system and bought their own franchise to operate. And so in doing so, that depletes those general manager characteristics from happening. So what you would expect is with the less of that, but people being entrepreneurs, are they training up the next general manager base and giving people enough experience? But I do think we have more accessibility to funding and so forth. So some of these people that might be stepping towards that general manager position are actually skipping the general manager position and moving to the entrepreneur position. And so, yes, the finding the motivated general manager that wants to be paid on a salary basis, maybe plus a bonus on performance, does become difficult. And now we're getting it sliced up into all the different industries. And so, not just a general manager. We all think that you need the general manager that's been from this industry because it's easier. You don't have to train them as much. They already know what's going on. As much as that's great, maybe some of the best talent are not just from the industry that you're in, and you just need to work with them and coach them in the right direction that they can be the next best general manager for you. But yes.
Well, tell us what packouts is about.
Sure. So packouts is the content section of the restoration world. So if you think about disaster restoration, not just, oh, rebuilding something in your house and you want to restore your house a little bit. We deal with disaster restoration. So if you have a flood, a fire, mold, the whole idea of the industry is you have to the mitigation, and you have to remove the problem. And then usually to remove the problem, you have to remove people's personal belongings. So we deal with just that section, the personal belonging. We inventory them, we clean them if necessary, and we store them while their property is being put back into its regular state and livable. And so that's our focus. So we deal with all personal belongings, and we deal with the insurance world. We can deal with it from a direct-to-consumer role if we want, if they want it that way. But a majority of our work comes out of an insurance-based lead, if you would. Somebody had a water leak, or they had flood damage, or rain damage, storm damage from a tornado, or straight-line winds, or hurricanes. All of that goes on. Fires are the other element. Kitchen fires tend to get soot all over the house because it gets into the AC system and blows dirt everywhere. So all those elements impact, and we only focus on the personal property side, only the contents of the property. That's what we
Well,
deal with.
obviously, we're talking about clothes. What other things do our personal property?
Sure. Everything, furniture, electronics, art, fine art is another one. We don't do it. We usually subcontract that out. That's a very special element. There are a few vendors in the industry that focus on this, and insurance companies want that if you have a really big, valuable piece of fine art. But a lot of furniture, the bed, dressers, coffee tables, kitchen tables, sofas, all your belongings. You'd be shocked at how much stuff you actually have when something happens. You always do it when you move. You're like, where did this all come from?
No, I wouldn't, because we had a cellar disaster, and then we had a disaster in our move, and between the two of them, I hate to tell you what happened. But well, let me ask you this question then. Somebody comes to you and says, I'm thinking of your franchise. What are some of the questions they should be asking you, and what are some of the questions you should be asking them?
That's a great question. Some of the questions that I think all people that are looking at a business, no matter what, they need to look at the fit. And so they need to be asking what type of lifestyle are they thinking that they're going to balance with the business that they want to be in. And I think, as you would know, the first year to 2 years is a lot of work of owning your own business. And I think that's a little bit of a misconception that some folks have coming in. They think that they, like you said, they jump in and there it is, money's coming in the door. You got to work a lot on that. So that's one of the things they need to ask. Is this a 24/7 job? If you look at the mitigation side of our industry, most of your calls are coming in the middle of the night. Ours are not. Ours are set a little more towards the regular daytime hours, 5 days a week. That's a question to ask. What's the involvement? Do you want to ask what support mechanisms are involved by the franchisor? What are they going to deliver? What's the process? How do they work with you? You want to then ask, what types of franchisees are there? How's the network? Because that's the support mechanism that you have. That's the backbone. It's not just calling the franchisor. You want to call other people that are doing the day-to-day. And it's a brother and sisterhood. It's a family type of element where you can pick up the phone and call an owner in a different location. Say, I'm dealing with this today. Have you dealt with this? How do you do it? Then you want to talk to get back into the support mechanisms of where are they can, what other elements do you bring to the table as a franchisor? Do you have buying power that helps me get discounts on things? That translates to profitability down the road for you. So those are the types of questions. Protection of the market that you're buying. Do you allow other franchise owners to enter the same market? So then you know if you do, you have a chance to compete against your own brand in a market. That may not be what you want to do. So that's another thing to think about when you're asking a franchise or a business of what they're going to do. What we ask owners, what are you looking to get out of this? How quickly are you looking to make this your mainstay for you and your family? We don't want folks that are looking, they think they're going to get paid and break even in 2 months of being open, that they have the right business mentality to it. We look at empathy in our business because we deal with people's personal properties at a time of urgency, in a time of disaster. They are in shock when something happened. They don't know what their next step is. And so if you're robotic and you don't really care, you're just trying to do the job, that's not going to translate very well to someone that's trying to figure out if they're able to keep an antique piece that's been in their family for a little bit. Offering solutions. So we work through that with that candidate. So those are the types of questions we look at as well for a candidate coming on board.
Well, it's got to be tough dealing with the insurance company that wants to minimize their money, and the homeowner is sitting there. You got a tough role. You got a tough job there.
It is difficult, but part of it is we try to help the homeowner understand what rights they actually have in their insurance policy. Many folks don't really know what their insurance policy and homeowners policy covers. For example, one of the big things that happened in the hurricane that moved all the way into Asheville, North Carolina, and you saw flooding in the mountains. It was flooding. And many homeowners didn't have flood insurance.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, because it was declared a flood, they didn't have coverage for it. Now, folks that lived on the coast know this. They have flood coverage. And so it's a lot of it's how the disaster is defined. If it's straight line winds, you're going to be covered for that in most cases. So we try to help the homeowner understand what their coverage is. And then, as the insurance company and an adjuster will say, just wipe it down. Don't clean it, just wipe it down. We'll talk to the homeowner and say, here's what the adjusters have provided to us. We're going to wipe this down. These are the things you do have the right to ask for it to be professionally cleaned, and we can do that. And then we give them the choice. Many homeowners want that professionally cleaned, and they'll go ask the adjuster, and it's immediately approved. But we want to make sure that the homeowner is getting their needs taken care of. And so we try to help be a liaison between the insurance company and the homeowner to understand some of those difficulties because it's not something you do every day.
Well, who calls you in, the homeowner or the insurance company, or do you try to be an ambulance driver
No.
or fireman?
Well, I mean, there's certain times you want to be there to help folks, but it's not, we do not do that on the, we don't chase, if you would, like the ambulance chaser, like some lawyers may do and so forth. That's not our recommendation of what to do. But we get probably a majority of our phone calls come from an insurance carrier or their adjuster or a mitigation contractor that's already been involved to remedy whatever the problem is. We do get some calls from homeowners. Because they get the choice. A homeowner actually has the choice to select who they want to work on their property. It
But
is
they
not
don't know that
dictated. That's
most
correct.
of the time.
That's correct. You're correct. And that's where some homeowners have learned that they do make the phone call and we get involved and we try to help them. Even if we're not the ones that are selected, we still want to make sure they're getting the best choice that meets whatever their needs are and not just being forced into something that may be not as good for them. But it's not our choice to do that. We present who we are. We talk to the homeowner and allow them to make any choices that they need. But you're correct. Most don't know that they actually have the final choice. It is not
Let's stop
dictated.
here. What's your website for people so if they want to know more?
Sure. Very easy. 1-800-PACKOUTS.com. It's very simple to remember. It's also an active phone number. We answer 24/7 through a call center, and we try to place any contacts that come through directly into a location where the call is coming from. So they're dealing with somebody on the ground, not just in a central corporate location. It's all done. We try to make it as local as possible.
Well, where are you located? Nationally. Where's your headquarters?
Our headquarters is out of Springville, Utah, and we have a catastrophe annex based out of Fort Worth, Texas. And so we have multiple locations in that situation, but the catastrophe annex houses some extra materials for our franchise owners in case of large catastrophes where you need a volume of boxes and equipment to handle and help homeowners in a major situation.
Well, let's stop for a moment and talk about dry cleaning. Everybody has clothes in the cellar. I don't care who you are. And they get damaged or they get water. Well, do you then contract with a local cleaner? What? How does that work?
So, for 1-800 packouts, we have some of our owners actually have the equipment on property in their own facilities. And so they can take care of all of that right there for the homeowner. We store and maintain all property in our own secured warehouses and temperature controlled warehouses. So we don't put them in public facilities. They're all controlled and security by our owners. So some of them can do all the dry cleaning, if you would, around the textile element. So that can be clothes or drapery or bedding. And then if they do not have the capability to do that in-house, we do have partnership with a national wholesaler. So it doesn't go to your local dry cleaner. It goes to a professional dry cleaner that's going to work on more of the disaster elements. So it's going to be around soot or water, like you said, to make sure that it's done at a professional level for the type of damage that has happened, the dirty that happened. If it happened from sewer water, you want to make sure that it's done and done properly, not just once over. So there's processes in the dry cleaning industry that takes care of that in the textile world, using the right type of product to do it, but also protect the garment as well.
Well, let's talk about money for a minute, if we may. If you have to have your own facility, what are we talking about in terms of working capital that you need?
So on the working capital, so we have in our franchise disclosure document that a startup for the business can run between the minimum around 200,000 up to the 500,000 mark to get things going. From that, the working capital you have to think about is your facility is number one. That's the largest cost that you're going to see. The next thing that you want to put into your consideration is the vehicles that you need. The minimum of one truck. There are multiple options you can use, so cash flow can be managed, but you do have to execute a job. You will have to have the vehicle. Production, for that, you can have 1099 labor for some of it. You do have to train them. Depending on the job, you may not be able to. They need to be background checked on certain jobs. And that's something that we help our franchisees know where that is. So when you look at it, it can vary based on the rent, the lease of a truck. Any staff that you're going to have, we recommend that you have a salesperson on staff from the very beginning because you want to continue the momentum of looking and working for the work. And then the production side, usually an owner starts on the production side as they start at zero and they start to grow their business. They will run that production side, usually bringing in part-time labor from a pool of people that they have vetted themselves, put in through some background checks. And know that they can pull from a group when they have a job that pops up. So those are the basics. The other one that you have to watch is your insurance. You have to be fully insured. Insurance companies do not hire folks that do not have insurance for to do the work that's available. So that can vary all over the place. I can't give a direct number on that because it would be different in Texas and California, for example. And you go to New York and prices are going to vary again. So but that's where you're going to balance out to see what your working capital necessity is.
You know, Stefan, oh, it's been so fascinating. We've almost come to the end of the half hour, and we never got to your topic. I'm much rather talk about that because I think people are very interested in it. But let me ask you another question. Let's say a retail operation has a flood. Is it different? Is the process different, or is it more difficult, less difficult? Can we address it when someone owns it? Because 97% of our audience own a business or run a business. So
It's a little bit different. It depends on what's going to be in it. So the retail shop has, right, you're going to have different insurances that cover that loss of work due to a storm damage. So you still are going to be able to make some money while you're closed. But we work with a lot of folks and they want to get open as fast as possible. Again, so they're making revenue, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. You want to make the revenue. That's how you make your margins. You make profit. So again, it depends on what needs to be done. A lot of that can be done very quickly. So if it's a retail store with shelving and it had water come through, the mitigation is going to be the largest part of that. And then all of the retail shelving material that's used can be removed, cleaned, and be ready to go back once it's all built back. The material that the product that they have is going to be the next thing. Is it salvageable or not salvageable? That's a big question. So if it's a retail store that sells clothing, if it got wet, most likely, I don't think that's going to be salvageable at a brand new retail level. And so that's an insurance that they already have. There's going to be coverage on that, how to deal with it. We can probably get it clean for them. What they're going to do with it will be up to that retailer on what they're going to do. If it's a, and I like, you know, a store that has physical products in it, it depends on how damaged it got. If it was a fire and it's soot, we can clean everything and get it back up and ready to go, and it didn't damage the product. If it was sitting in water for a day, like after a catastrophe storm, you know, again, it's going to go back to that retailer. No, they know what they're going to be able to do with it or not do with it. And so that's where it's going to continue to vary. We've dealt with offices. We can re legal law office flooded, a medical facility flooded. You can actually save the paper and the documents. A lot is now stored electronically. But we can do a lot, and that's where they're going to want to get folks around the content and the mitigation side in to know what can be done to help them. But it is a little different on the commercial side of it.
Well, Stefan, we only have about 2 minutes left. What would you like to leave our audience with? But first, start by giving your website again for people who want to learn more.
Absolutely. Our website is 1-800-PACKOUTS.com. And we're happy to answer any questions, whether it's business related or disaster related. We'll help anybody, even to review their policies to make sure they're protected. For example, if they're a small business, what happens if this is, and what do I need to ask is my first question. So that's something I would leave with folks as
I
well.
was surprised. 70% of all small businesses do not have interruption insurance. I didn't know if you.
That's correct. That's what I've seen as well. My wife has a business that she runs, and we do not have interruption insurance. It's a cost that I think a lot of folks look at, but they're trying to save their money. Insurances have gotten so expensive. But the question is, where are you located? What's the situation? There's certain places I would say don't pass on it. It's the same with homeowners. Don't pass on flood insurance in certain areas. Do an evaluation on it. Flood insurance isn't necessarily an outrageous cost, but evaluate it if you have a home and you think you might be at risk. It's worth taking a look, not just if you're in a flood zone. So those are just some things, but you know that you have a choice as a business owner or a homeowner, that when something happens, you have a choice. You're not just forced and required to use something that's thrown at you. Do a little research. We do vary. There's a lot of us in the industry of restoration. We're all here to help people. Most of us are very used to dealing with this on a regular basis. And it's not just 1-800-PACKOUTS, it's the industry. We take pride in that as an industry, and we're here to help folks. As I say, I don't have a lot of repeat homeowner customers, because if you are a repeat customer, you either have really bad luck or you have a lot of houses, if you look at it that way. So, you
But
know,
do you
we,
get
so it's something
referrals?
new all the time.
Do you get people to tell you, for instance,
Absolutely.
they're
Yes. And I mean, it's a large referral business, and that's how you get a lot of information, right? You hear from someone, something happened to you. You're seeing if someone you know in your family or your friends, maybe it happened. Nobody's running around saying, I had this great experience from this company that took care of my belongings. I worked in pest control. You don't go to a party and talk about the pest control that you have at your house, but
No.
you have it, you know, because so again, it comes in a time of need. And so ask the questions. And I think more and more folks are doing that on a regular basis. And then that's where you're going to find out if you had a good feeling, you're going to tell people when they're asking about that. Oh yeah, call 1-800-PACKOUTS. They helped us out a ton. They really knew what was going on and they took care of a lot of stuff. So that's what we're proud of.
Well, on that note, we say thank you, Stefan, for a very interesting and illuminating time together.
I appreciate it, Don. Thanks for having me on.
Why, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions? I grew up in the ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone. And my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveled. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore.
I'm Mazzella here again for Small Business Digest. Glad to be back on the circuit. We have with us today Larry Tracy. Now, he's an ex-military officer, but he's here to talk about how to get across your ideas in your company. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Don.
Well, you know, as we ask all of our guests, first, tell us a little bit about your personal background. Then a little bit about what you're doing now and your new book, and finally, where people can learn more.
Well, I'm a retired Army colonel. I like to say that I did more speaking than shooting, and it was speaking that I think got me promoted to colonel because it's kind of difficult to make that rank. I was a Latin American specialist. I'd spent a year in Argentina traveling all over the area. I was assigned to the Defense Intelligence Agency. And for some reason, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted to know what was happening in Argentina. It was a rather strange country. So I gave a briefing to the chairman, which was sort of a mixture of military intelligence, and it turned out to be stand-up comedy. The chairman, who never smiled, was sort of falling out of his chair as I was regaling what was happening in Argentina. And the next day, the director, a three-star general, called me up to his office and he said, "I like the way you handled yourself with the chairman. I like the way he reacted to you. I'm going to place you in charge of the briefing team. You'll be the best-known major in the building. But if you do anything to screw up, I'll fire you in a minute and that'll ruin your career. Do you want the job?" Well, in a situation like that, I said, yes, sir. I didn't want to say, oh, no, I don't want to get into any situation that caused me problems. So I held the job for close to 3 years. This was during the latter part of the Cold War. I had a 10-person team, and introduced a woman onto the briefing team for the chairman for the first time. So I guess I was a pathbreaker on that. And I had these five briefers, and I had the graphic technicians. And we briefed all over the building, not just the chairman, because people wanted to know, what did the chairman hear today? So we set it up, and we tailored our briefings for them as to what they needed to know. And I, as I said, I held it for about 3 years. Then I went back to my specialty of Latin America. I was assigned to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. This was when during the Reagan administration in the Central America. And I was very involved in developing that policy. But also I spoke for the Pentagon. Whenever they wanted anybody to speak, given my background, I would be the one to do it. The White House caught word of this or learned of it, and they assigned me then to the State Department, because State Department has the main responsibility of explaining foreign policy. So then in the next 3 years, I gave a couple of hundred presentations, mostly on college campuses and mostly to rather hostile audiences. So it was a great learning experience. And after that, I retired from the Army. I went into the field of speech coaching, and I did that many times working with small businesses who had small business set-aside proposals they were responding to. And frequently, the government required an oral presentation, not just a written proposal. And so that's where I came in to train them in that. I remember specifically one fellow who was an IT expert telling me, he said, I went into IT so I wouldn't have to give speeches. I wouldn't have to sell. And now my company and my own job depends on my ability to speak. So he was a very receptive student to it. And I think the main lesson that I drew myself from that was that no matter how small or how large your business is, the second business of anybody is making presentations, of making skills. You just can't go and have a project that you'd go through. Let's say you're a tax accountant and you get invited to speak at a Rotary Club. Now, I've spoken to a lot of Rotary Clubs, and I know one of the benefits, not considered a benefit normally, they're limited to 20 minutes. You get your story done in 20 minutes, or you're going to be talking a lot of dirty dishes because people are getting back to run their own businesses then. So I found that this was a good thing for them to do, and I preached constantly. That phrase I've used, the second business of any business is making presentations. No matter how good an accountant you are, or an IT expert, or computer repair, if you get up in front of an audience and you have your presentation filled with uhs, you knows, and all those fillers, and you speak in a monotone, they're going to write you off. You've got to learn the techniques of speaking. And I did that. And then after I sort of waned off on that a bit, the COVID sort of cut back a little on those type of workshops. I started to write a book. And the book I wrote that I think you've seen, Dan, is that How to Bring Home the Bacon. It's a good term, I think, to use. It attracts a lot of attention. I'm dealing with a company right now to sell rights in Europe, which means you've got to turn that title around. I can't say that. People in Germany and France would think that I'm talking about going out to get breakfast food. It's got the principle, because it's a universal problem. The fear of speaking. People are concerned about it. And the skills that they bring forth in their jobs, whatever their profession is so much easier than making a speech. But giving a presentation has a psychological impact on it. So that's what I've been doing, and moving the book, and still doing workshops as well, but concentrating more on the book, because I think it's a workshop in a book. I wrote the book based on all the work and my notes and my slides from the workshops I gave. So it's a way in which a person can develop a fairly good ability to speak by reading the book.
Well, Larry, let me ask you this question first. I was always taught that you have to get your main point across at the very beginning, because no matter, you don't know how long you're going to get or how your audience will be. What do you say to that?
Well, it's how you draft your presentation. Let's go back to when we were in first grade. We did our first show and tell. Introduction, body, conclusion. And we bring that into adult life. I think that's a terrible way to prepare a presentation. Instead of developing it 1, 2, 3, develop it 3, 1, 2. Develop your conclusion first. Come to your bottom line. And in the military, we had an expression, bottom line up front. If you're going to be shortened in time, at least have that ready. And again, I go back to a Rotary Club. It's a great example because of the 20-minute limit. And if you're up there and you're trying to attract attention, build your brand, you better be, if you want to have your conclusion really hard-hitting, and you develop that. If you develop your, if you start with a 1, 2, 3, the presentation in your presentation, then you're going to find you're spending all of your time in your introduction. And by the time is running out, you don't have any time for it. So if your 20-minute presentation is reduced suddenly to 10 minutes, and that could easily happen, then at least you've got your introduction and your conclusion. You can get the supporting documentation later, but you want to have them leave with your most important aspect, how your skills, your company can help them improve their own work. So I think that's it. So you work backwards. That's the best way to do it. Anybody who goes and develops a presentation, 1, 2, 3, is destined to have that problem. They're going to be running out of time, and they're never going to get their main point across.
Well, let me ask you this question, Larry. I know somebody, someone who I consider one of the greatest salesmen I ever met, and he said you start off something by asking them, what are your needs?
That's a good approach, but you should have that information before you start to draft your presentation. You want to get this intelligence ahead of time. What is it that they need? And then be able to focus that way. You could still ask the question and hopefully they come back with an answer that's similar to what your intelligence has found. But the more work you do ahead of a presentation, the better you'll be. It'll also develop your confidence. This fear of speaking is universal. There was a famous study done in the 70s by the London Sunday Times. Asked people, what is your greatest fear? And fear of public speaking came out number one. Dying came a few places later. That led the comedian in the 80s, Jerry Seinfeld, to say, if you attend a funeral, and you'd rather be in the coffin than deliver the eulogy. Well, that's a bit overdrawn, but that shows how deep-seated. And I saw this in every workshop I did. I saw this fear of speaking. People were apprehensive. Some people refused to go to the training is because of the fact
I'm right in the middle of the show.
Have to make
Can
a speech.
Pull you back in 20 minutes.
Your peers.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Are you there now? You are? Okay. Hold on a second. I'll get my wife to put you. Hold on. Sorry, Larry.
That's no problem.
Hold on.
That's a good example of what can happen in a presentation, right there. You can get an interruption.
I'm going to put you on hold for 1 second. Okay. As fast as, but Larry, let me talk about you remember the old one that said, imagine that your audience is naked or a butcher? You remember ever hear that one? How should you engage your audience? How do you talk to an audience in your view?
Well, I think you should be as natural as possible. I don't think you should be up there stiff and formal. If you're speaking to a group of fellow small business people, you talk to them as, I'm one of you, and I know your problems. I have the same problems, but I think we can work together on this and make your presentation sort of a cooperative operation with the other people to whom you're speaking. The idea of asking them, what is your needs, is fine, but you better have an answer already, and it's better to do that with pre-presentation work.
Okay, let's stop a moment. How can you have people get your book and talk to you?
What was that? I didn't get that.
How can people get your book and if they want to talk to you?
It's on Amazon, but I think the more direct way to get it, the publisher, I know it's a strange name, they're called Book Baby. They're in Pennsauken, New Jersey, not far from where you used to live. And they have their own website. And the best way to get it is to go to store, STORE, dot bookbaby com and then slash and put my name down, Larry Tracy. It'll be a lot faster to do that. And you'll be able to get the print as well as the ebook version of it. And I think you'll find that it is, in fact, as I say, it's a workshop and a book. It takes you through how to plan, how to practice, and how to present. And when I started this, Don, I didn't say this at the beginning. When I was a second lieutenant, a sergeant major came up to me. He'd heard me give a talk, and he said he thought I had potential. And he said, let me tell you what I did in my whole time in the Army. He said, I had four words that guided me: anticipate, draft, practice, deliver. And that's gradually merged into. But you want to have a system that whatever you're speaking on, you can fit into this and do it. And that became what I call the S3P3 system. That's included in the book. And the key areas, I'd say, in the book, one is, I've already mentioned, is drafting. Draft backwards so that you are able to have the emphasis on your conclusion, your solution to their problem, and then you state the problem up front. And the other one is the practice system. In the military, we use the term, and it's spread out of the military as well, and that is that of a murder board. It means a very, very tough practice session. There's a little bit of a delicacy here. If you're afraid of speaking and then you go up in front of peers and you have a tough one, not bad. So you have to judge that how it will be. But you want to go into a presentation confident that you have the answers to the questions your audience is going to answer. And that guided me all the way through. I had murder boards every time I would go out to speak to college. I would call back to the operations center at State Department to find if anything big had occurred that was negative, and I'd anticipate in that. And I enjoyed this tremendously because I was debating professors who had spent their entire career opposing military dictatorships. Now they were supporting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, which was a military dictatorship. And so it was a lot of fun. The students sometimes, I had them laughing, but they couldn't laugh too much because these guys were passing their grades out to them. But the more you speak, you're going to find that psychological pressure, that fear of speaking drops, and you'll be a lot more confident in speaking. And when you're up there in front of that business group or whatever they are, you're delivering a message. You might even think of yourself as a chef, and you're delivering the food that they actually need, and they walk away. You want the audience to walk away saying, I learned something. I'm going to be able to put this into practice. And who is this guy that I just listened to? I'm going to go to him. You're selling yourself as much as you're selling your business.
That's true. Before we go further, someone also said you should talk in a lower, so people have to lean in to hear. How do you feel about that?
I had that problem. As I told you, I had a hearing aid problem.
Sorry. Now can you hear me?
Go ahead.
They said you should lower your voice so people have to lean in to hear you. What do you say to that?
I would say you can lower your voice, but you want to just change the variable. What you don't want to do is speak in a monotone. The monotone is just absolutely death for a speaker. And if you want to, you can go and you say, now, one thing that is very important, and lower your voice. And they will lean in a little bit when that one, but set it up. Just don't drop your voice down without any warning to the audience while you're doing this. But because you can certainly set the line up. The most important thing that I have learned, I want to tell you, is this. Pause and then give it. The little, what I call shortcuts to eloquence are very important. When you speak in rhythms of three, for reasons we really don't know, when we say something in threes, and you'll see great speeches always have that in, it just brings a rhythm to it. It brings something to the audience that they are, and you're reinforcing each point, with each sentence of three. And pausing is important. You don't have to go and run through, and that's one of the crises that we have when we have to make a presentation and we know we're going to run out of time. We decide to talk as fast as we can. I'm from Philadelphia. You're living in Wilmington, very close. We have a tendency to talk really, really fast. But in a speech, you want to slow it down, change your pace, and bring the audience around so that they're attuning, they're listening to your speaking. And then you get the message across. You're never going to have an audience that understands or listens to 100% of what you said, but you want to have your points made very clearly. And that's why you develop your conclusion first, so you have a little time. I call it the final arrow. The last thing you say is, and if there's a moderator and he said you've got 20 minutes, make sure you stop at about 18 minutes. And then say, now, one final thing, even if it's repetitious, you're repeating yourself, get that point out that is the most important. And it causes the audience to say, I want to hire this person. I think this person is just what I need for my business to be able to increase my brand, increase the credibility of my firm. This is the one I need. And a lot of that comes from your personality and your likability. Likability is an extremely important aspect of speaking. And that goes back to Aristotle. When he wrote The Rhetoric, he talked about the fact that you want your audience to like you, and then they're more likely to accept what you have to say.
Well, that's very true. Well, what about the other side of it? How do you ask for the sale?
Well, that's going to be one of the problems that you probably don't want to ask for the sale in a general presentation. You want to just set to say, here I am, this is what I have. But you want to have established already that what your capability is, it coincides with what their need is. And that's that pre-presentation intelligence. What is it that they need? And focus on that. And if you're doing this with an individual, the same thing. I just can't emphasize enough the need to have pre-presentation intelligence. Get as much as you know about that person so you can inflict. If they're a sports fan, somehow bring sports into it. And you can talk about that and then slide over from the sports to what you can do to win the game. And they're in a more receptive way.
Well, let me ask you this question. Let's get back. Are women better presented than men?
Well, that's an interesting question because it gets back into the way the brain is formed. A man won the Pulitzer Prize, not the whatever prize it was for medicine, back in 1980. And he had done analyses of brains from corpses, of course, and he found that there were more neural paths connecting the left brain and the right brain. The right brain, the creative, the left brain, the mathematical. And I like to look at it as there are more highways connecting this city to this city. And women have a greater number of those. The disadvantage that women have is that their voice can sometimes be a little bit too high-pitched, and they have to, but I have to admit, if you have a choice between a man and a woman to brief for other differences, keep in mind that brain difference. There's a lot better, more of the way that women can integrate information to you. They can be better. But in our society, it is men who tend to make most of the presentations. But you see a lot of women on, how many women newscasters do you see? And that's, I think it goes back to that fact of the brain being wired differently. And more importantly, make some better speakers.
I always cite this statistic, which is now 2 years old, but of 22 teams pitching for money in a recent program, angel presentations, of the 44, only one of them had a woman presenter.
Well, that could be a mistake. They'd have to know the audience. How does the woman present? When I have women in my workshops, I have to be very careful about this because if they're sort of high-pitched, I want them to just lower the pitch a little bit, but then they could think that I'm being a sexist about this and I want them to imitate a man. But when they see that their voice can be irritant, then they do lower. And a woman with a low, for instance, my great friend in government and in school, my professor, was the late Jean Kirkpatrick. And Jean was an excellent speaker, but one of the things is she spoke lower. She told me that I wasn't even into the field of speaking at the time. She said, I've always found as a woman, I'm going to be judged differently than a man. So I lower my voice just a little bit. Did it work? I thought she was a fabulous speaker and person, so she did.
Interesting you brought her up. I also knew her, and exactly the same thing she said to me. Interesting. Very interesting woman. Who do you, in your view, in all your time together, who do you think was the best presenter that you ran across besides yourself?
Well, you mean at say the political level?
Any level.
Well, I think as a student of great speakers, and I've looked at them, I've always admired Winston Churchill. Not only his intelligence, but his ability, his way of framing. Ronald Reagan, who I worked for, he, of course, was a trained actor. And that, I mentioned Gene. Currently, it's hard to say who are the better speakers of the politicians. I think J.D. Vance is very good. Donald Trump has a unique style that I probably wouldn't fit into being that, but he gets his point across. But I'd rate Winston Churchill, Martin Luther King, who had that rhythm of coming from the black church. And I could listen to his speeches all the time. And certainly Reagan would fit in there right away. Well, I'll tell you one story on Reagan. I used to go over and speak at the White House when he would speak. I'd be the fourth speaker. That have him speaking first. And one time it was the Social Security Administrator and the Secretary of the Treasury, who was Reagan. So in my turn that came up, I said, well, Reagan, Reagan, McSheen, and Tracy. Sounds like a South Boston law firm. That just got them laughing a little bit. But I watched the way he used 3x5 cards. It was masterful. He would move the card. I was looking at his eyes. I was about 5 feet from him. He wouldn't seem to look at the card, but he just moved right on to it. And I would advise that as an aside. Use 3x5 cards instead of a script of any sort. You can move them back and forth. You can take some out to shorten your presentation and that. But after the presentation was over, Reagan had made a joke about his age. And I forget what it was, something about Thomas Jefferson. And he said, and you know, when Tom told me that, and the audience busts up laughing. So do I. I'm standing next to a Secret Service agent who had let me stand next to him. And he leans down to me as I'm bent over laughing. And he said, Colonel, you just blew your cover. Mm-hmm. And Reagan is looking over at me and he sort of smiles. They get up on, Secret Service agent gets up onto the stage. And Reagan turns and looks at me. And I couldn't hear what they said, but it was probably, who's the new agent that laughs at my joke? And the Secret Service agent probably said, I got good news and bad news. The good news is he's not one of us. The bad news, he's the guy selling your policy. And Reagan just laughed at this and just smiled at me. And all I could do would be to smile back at him on it. But he was a master. I just admired him. Anytime I could get near him when he was speaking, I'd do it just to observe how he was doing it. And probably that a lot of that came into my own speaking, watching him and his views.
When he died, the media was surprised at the outpouring of real affection for the man. What do you think made him so beloved?
You mean rate him as a speaker?
A speaker and just as a person. When he died.
And I would just, there's no question, I was a Reagan man all the way. Voted for him, was proud to work for him, and certainly the Central American policy was his most controversial, and I was glad that I had that opportunity. Back here, right below the picture of the cathedral, you may see a letter from Ronald Reagan to me that I got at my retirement ceremony. Mm. And just having that hanging up on the wall has always been one. I just thought the man was wonderful. I never saw many of his movies. I don't know what sort of an actor he was, but he said at one time that he couldn't be a president if he wasn't an actor. And that maybe a lot of people can study that took a lot of concern and while he got a lot of his skills from Hollywood certainly came into when he was a speaker, when he was back on what 20 Mule Team Burax, I think was when he was in television a lot and he made that hit. And I remember watching him then and just liking him at that point, not even before he got into politics. So my politics is pretty clear on that. I was a Reagan guy all the way.
Well, on that note, Larry, we're going to have to say thank you for a very enjoyable time together.
Well, thank you very much, Don. Now that I've subscribed to the Small Business Digest, I hope I can write some articles for you to help your readers
well,
be able
to... I'm going to put up one before the end of the week.
Okay. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to be in your army.
Okay.
You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of a guest you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.